Hi, this is Tom Purcell. You're listening to Improv Nerd.
Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Jimmy Crane's an improv nerd. Jimmy Crane's a nerd. Oh, Jimmy.
Hey, everybody. Jimmy Crane, and this is another episode of Improv Nerd, sponsored by the good people at Hotel Lincoln. The next time you find yourself here in the city of Chicago and you're looking for a cool boutique hotel that's close to everything, including the Second City, and it's not only improviser-friendly, it's pet-friendly as well, check out the official hotel of Improv Nerd, the Hotel Lincoln. We're also sponsored by Uncle Fun here in Chicago. For almost three decades, Uncle Fun has been a Chicago institution. So if you're a kid or a grown-up, you will find one of the most enormous selections of fun stuff from around the globe. From cool vintage toys to novelty items, unique treasures, and cards. If you end up spending $1 or $100, I guarantee you will always leave with a bigger smile on your face. Uncle Fun is at 1338 West Belmont here in Chicago. Our guest today is Tom Purcell. He is the executive producer of The Colbert Report, and he talked to us about when he first realized he wanted to be a comedy writer at the age of 15. He also talked to us about working in Chicago and at the Second City, and why he thinks Stephen Colbert is probably one of the most talented people he's ever worked with. Also, at the end of this episode, Tom offers practical advice when submitting a writing packet to The Colbert Report.
This is Neil Hamburger. Hey, I don't know if you podcast people even watch the news, but it's a real catastrophe right now in the Philippines. They had a horrible typhoon, and it's just a goddamn mess. Those folks need assistance. So Tim Heidecker and myself put together a little six-minute track, an exclusive MP3 titled Taco Bell Apple Tree, which Tim and I will send out to anyone who donates $10 or more to one of the many legit organizations offering relief down there. Go to feralaudio.com for all the details on how you can help.
Before we get to the interview with Tom, I just want to share a quick story with you about the time that I got to work with Stephen Colbert here in Chicago back in, I'm going to say it's probably the early 90s. And we had both been cast in an industrial film. And if you don't know anything about industrial films in terms of the food chain, it is the lowest level on the food chain. And people really kind of turned their nose at it and were kind of snobby about doing an industrial film. You kind of felt like a sellout and you didn't put much effort into it, or at least I didn't. And it was a Siskel and Ebert parody. Stephen Colbert was going to play Siskel, and I was going to play Ebert. I was much heavier in those days. And so I remember showing up on the set, and Stephen Colbert, at that time, you know, he was, you know, a big main stage star at Second City, and being really excited to get to work with him. And Stephen showed up, and he was so professional. And he was so playful, and he was so respectful to everybody, from the makeup person to the cameraman to the director. He had his lines down. He had obviously taken a shower and shaved, which is different than how I show up to things. I showed up. I didn't have my lines down. I'm disheveled. I probably didn't shave and shower, didn't get a good night's sleep. And Stephen shows up like it's a job. And the people that I've worked with who are the most successful have gone on that I've gotten to work with, and it doesn't matter if they're doing a shitty industrial for some shitty product and some shitty trade show, convention center, or they're doing a major motion picture, they show up the same way, and they show up like it's a job. So here you go. Here is the Tom Purcell episode. I think you're really going to enjoy it.
He's a nerd. Oh, yeah. Jimmy's a nerd. He's a nerd.
Pardon?
There's a lot of people on this wing, so it's rude.
So you grew up here in Chicago. I mean, St. Joe Music, yes.
Yeah, St. Joe's, Michigan, across.
Right.
Yeah.
And then Oak Park.
No, Oak Park first. I'll go through, like, the sad story of moving around a lot.
I love sad.
My father was a law professor, went to Loyola, graduated very high in his class, start teaching right out of law school, basically. Gets a job in Kansas City to open up the UMKC Law School. We live in Kansas City for like 4 years. I've got a sister who's handicapped. Okay.
What do you mean by that?
She's deaf and developmentally disabled. Okay. And about 3.5 feet tall or something, 4 feet tall.
Can we just go on a tangent? How does that change you being compassionate? How does it change?
I'm more likely to make fun of the handicapped, I'll tell you that.
Are you serious?
Well, no, I mean, it's like my sister always says. Like, when you see, like, Corky on Life Goes On,
right, the
you don't see the part where Corky's a selfish pain in the ass. And so, like, it makes you, like, you've got this well-rounded, like, view of a handicapped person who can be just as stubborn and just as selfish as anybody else you know, and then they're able to go, like, I can't help it, I'm deaf, you know? And so, as a small child, you know, I wasn't exactly Buddha, you know what I mean? So, like, as a small child, like, certain resentments would fester against the handicapped
kid. Like, give me one.
We moved just to Michigan because of my handicapped sister. Like, Illinois at that time, this is before the Americans with Disability Act. So Illinois was for shit on special ed. So my parents, imagine this. My parents had like a 3.5-year-old handicapped kid that they sent away to boarding school because that's the only way she was going to get educated. Like, think about that for a second. Like, as an adult, I can have all sorts of empathy and sympathy for my parents. You know, when you're a second grader and you've got to move to Michigan, or like sixth grader and you're moving to Michigan, you're like, fuck them, you know. Like, you just cannot feel that. So, like, it's things like that, you know. I mean, it's like, as an adult, it's probably helped my empathy, but as a child, I mean, what it did was my brother and I got to beat up on people who thought deaf was contagious. Like, they'd ostracize my sister, and she'd come home crying, and then we'd go, like, kick.
But you also said that you were bullied as a kid.
Oh, yeah.
And what did kids bully you about?
I was the smallest kid in class who was very smart and wouldn't shut the fuck up. So some of it I had coming. I had some of it coming. Because if you're small enough, you should shut the fuck up.
And then, after college, you decide, I mean, you could get into any law school you wanted.
Well, yeah, I suppose. I mean, a lot.
And then you have a breakdown, which leads you to comedy. What happened in the breakdown?
Oh, I so don't want to go into this. I don't know anybody who, like... Have you ever been stuck in a decision?
Right now.
Where, like... What a breakdown feels like to me is the incapability of making any decision, large or small, that I can see both sides of everything, and I'm caught in between, I won't just do. And then so the head is just spinning. And what it felt like was anxiety attacks.
Which is interesting because your mom suffered from anxiety.
Right.
She stopped driving a car, right?
Right, yeah. My mother was a horrific driver. See, my father always blamed it on her father. Like, my grandfather was the city editor of the Chicago Daily News. Mm-hmm. And, like, back then, like, the newspapers, you know, if it bleeds, it leads today. It was exactly the opposite. Like, they'd go and they would see people, you know, chopping up little children, and they wouldn't write about it, and they'd go, you know, like, you don't want to know what the world's really like. Like, that's basically it. So, like, he had been to thousands of auto accidents, and then is teaching my mother to drive. And so his evidently his message to my mother was, be afraid, be very afraid. And I remember as a small child, like, how terrifying it was to be, you know how it is when somebody's, like, not confident in what they do? Like, I tell, like, students and stuff, if you're going to do an open mic night, always walk on the stage like you're the pilot walking through a plane, because the audience doesn't want to see you not confident, you know what I mean? And imagine somebody behind the wheel who's going, no, I do not trust my ability to make it through this intersection. And I can't grab the wheel, I'm five.
So you have this breakdown, and the breakdown then leads to...
Well, I mean, I had always been doing comedy since, like, I was 16 or so. I I was lucky enough to go to a high school where they had based their student newspaper because they had read copies of the Michigan Lampoon, basically. And so it's an all-comedy newspaper paid for entirely by the students raising ads. The administration had no oversight. And so we could do whatever we want. And like, as a freshman, I saw this thing and I went, oh, I desperately want to do that. I desperately want to say whatever I want and nobody can tell me otherwise. I still desperately want to do that. You know what I mean? It's like, that's like what comedy is to me, kind of the idea of you don't have to lie about what your experience is like.
Well, but it's interesting because you write for somebody at the Colbert Report, mm-hmm. Stephen, who, and I say it like I'm good friends with him. But
well, you know him.
I do know him. We did an industrial long time ago. Was it an Ebert?
He remembers it because I brought this up to him.
Are you serious?
Yeah. And he goes, say hi to Jimmy. So.
Are you serious? Because I got to say something, and when I was at BEZ, and the book came out, which I imagine you had a hand in.
Right.
Right. And I tried to get him on, and I contacted you, and he said, I can't do it, or whatever. And I felt like, I thought we were good friends, you know? But I guess he's very busy.
Right. He's a guy who's got like five jobs. You know what I mean? Uh-huh. It's not like he doesn't like show up to work and clip on a mic and say the words.
Right.
He does everything. Like he is, no offense to you,
uh-huh.
He's probably the most talented guy I've ever met.
Right.
I mean, it's crazy. He can do everybody's job better than that. Like, does my job better than I do. You know what I mean? It's like, so he's busy.
And what made, you say he's the most talented. You've worked with, I mean, we could just name them off. Koechner, Farley, Clea Lewis, who was...
I was fortunate as to who was in that group, right?
I mean, there was tons of people that you work with. What makes him the most talented person you work with?
Because he can do everything. He, like, the thing with Colbert is he's a really gifted improviser, really gifted performer, mm-hmm. really gifted writer. He's a gifted director. He's, like, he's good at seeing, like, one of the things that is great about him is he understands what his own intention is in things.
What do you mean by that?
What are we trying to do here? We might fall short of what the scene is, but he's really good at being able to enunciate what it is we're trying to say.
Give me an example in the show.
In various like words, okay? When we're looking at words, it's like he'll know what art, he'll be able to enunciate very clearly what our editorial goal is, what his character goal is, and what are we using to achieve those two disparate objectives. You know what I mean? I can't remember because we've done a lot of them, and it just we perform them, and then like it goes out of my head. I'm sorry.
So let's say you have a guest on the show.
Right.
Okay, so he would approach it from an emotional level?
Right. Okay. I mean, the way we approach the guests, and when I first started there, because, you know, he and I have known each other a long time, we speak the same language, like, we would meet on every guest, just the two of us. Mm-hmm. And what he's looking for there is, what does my guy think about him? What does my guy really think about him? Not what do we think about him, what does the character think about him? And then we work backwards from there. Because what if he's really excited he's there, or he hates him, or like, I don't buy it, you know what I mean? It's like sometimes I don't, like the character's like, I don't buy your whole science thing, you know? I don't buy it, you know? Convince me, baby, you know? And that will be the keystone wherein you build whatever jokes or whatever questions he's gonna ask, because if you know what the guy thinks, you know what questions he really wants to get to. If he believes your whole science thing is a fraud, he's going to ask you different questions than if he worships your whole science thing. And so he's got great clarity in the work he does, you know. And so, like, most talented is probably an overstatement. Broadly talented is very fair to say for him.
How is he different from the persona, the character he plays?
Well, I don't want to give all that away, do I? I mean, it's night and day. They're not similar. I mean, its aspects of, I mean, the character, in my opinion, is id. You know what I mean? He's purely pure selfishness, pure ego, without any shame for that. You know what I mean? And so, like, to play him, I think he has to access his own ego, his own id or whatever, but he's nothing like that. He's not like that guy at all, because, you know, that guy is just, you know, I think we all have the fantasy of being, you know, look at me, I'm wonderful, like unapologetically walking through life going, you know, this is going on, you know what I mean? Like there's a part of me that wishes I could walk into every room and go, yeah, you'd like some of this, wouldn't you? And like that character is like the pure distillation to some extent of that shallowness is there, as well as he's modeling certain, you know, august news thing that I would let him speak about rather than me, because it's like he's put together a lot of different aspects of the character, with some of which are based on news personalities, you know, but in its core, it's a person who's not afraid to go, you know.
But you know what I think lately, too, is yeah. I think some of the stuff that I saw him do here at Second City mm-hmm. is kind of slipping into the character, and I really like it. And I'll give you an example. He did that, you did this great montage dance thing. Do you remember
yeah,
that?
Yeah.
Well, I don't think the first year of the show he would have done that.
No.
But I think he's getting more comfortable, and you guys are like expanding the character that's really reflecting more of his performance sensibilities. Would you agree to that?
I would agree with that. That, I mean, first of all, we've done like 1,200 of them. And like my joke at work always is I hate those guys. Because we'll think of something. I mean,
Who are those guys?
Has anyone noticed that since Obama's been president, and the news has effectively stopped in many areas, that the same story comes back every 6 months because there's a kind of a constipation of our legislative process. So immigration comes up, these same judges come up, you know, different issues just come, you know, we're shutting down the government again. You know what I mean? And like, so we'll sit down and we'll be talking about what we want to put on the show, and we'll have an idea for like, oh, this is for the government shutdown. And somebody will go, yeah, that was a great idea when we did it a year ago. And I go, I hate those guys. It's us a year ago who came up with funny things that then robbed from our ability to do it this year. I hate them. I just despise those.
And, you know, you were going to turn this job down, right?
Well, I was never going to turn it down. That's okay. Not fair.
Okay.
It was...
You can clear the record right now.
Right.
But you were not going to turn that job down.
Well, it was interesting because it came out of left field. I'd written... Like, I thought that I was pretty good.
As a writer?
Just good, just generally.
As a writer, whatever.
I was feeling good about myself. I was unemployed, and I was fine with that. And I had written this pilot that I thought was pretty good. And I wrote two pilots, one that everyone said was really good, and one everyone said was really horrible. And I don't talk about the one that they thought was horrible.
But we don't care about that one.
Yeah, nobody does. Nobody cares about the other one either. But it had a political theme to it. And so...
It was about the young Republicans?
Yeah. It's the young Republican thing. It was pretty funny. I don't know. Anyway. So my agency goes, you know, do you want to work for half your quote? I'm like, no.
For people to know half the quote, you're taking a pay cut.
Yeah, take
half,
a pay cut.
Half of
well,
what
but,
you...
but I'm, keep in mind, this is the sort of egomaniac. I'm unemployed.
Right.
That's just what my quote would be if I was working, but I'm not.
Right.
Okay? So it's like, you know, do you want to move to New York? Not really, because I was enjoying Los Angeles. But then they go, it's for Stephen Colbert. And I was like, oh. Because Colbert's, I've known him since the Levels. He's like the nice
levels,
guy.
Levels, meaning Second City.
Levels.
Like, he was a guy we looked up to him.
Well, to some extent, yeah. But I mean, like, You know Koechner tried to rope him into our thing of getting all those good improvisers together, right?
No, no, no.
Yeah, I don't want to speak out of turn, but like
that's what this show is about.
But like, you know, Koechner tried to get together like all of his friends to be in a class where people who have jobs couldn't do it. You remember that?
Yes.
Yeah. He approached Colbert, who was in a group of people. He was clearly the best improviser amongst them. You know,
but I remember when,
and he wouldn't do it because he did. He felt bad about like abandoning people who just because they're not as good at improv people as other people. He wasn't going to go, hey, screw you. Like he was nice. I always remember him that as like he's a really good guy, and like so when it was like Colbert, I was like, oh, he's a really good guy. This will probably be good. And then like, so my plan was. Well, I'll sell him some jokes, okay? I'll sell him some jokes. I live in L.A. And I wrote the packet. Like, you know how you can write things good or you can audition good when you don't really want it anyway? You know how that is?
No, like, I don't, but yeah. Yeah.
But you know what I'm saying? Like when you really, when it's life or death depends on getting this job, I'm the worst. Like, I'm not that great, maybe anyway, but like really, I grip it. I grip it hard. And so this was like, you know, you help the guy out. Like, literally, I hope his show's successful. So I sent him off, and he goes, yeah, I found this out. He goes, and I didn't want to read yours because I know you, and what if it was terrible? It was going to be awkward. Like, he goes, I don't see that often, but I was, like, cringing that you'd submit it because what if it's horrible? And somebody read it, and he liked it. And so next thing you know, like, they offered the job, and it's like, all right. I mean, once you submit, you can't go, no. You can't go, yeah, psych, you know what I mean? So suddenly I'm moving to New York. And like, to give you a sense of like what the show is like or why the show is, I think, good, but good to work on, definitely. He's a really good guy. He is, like, first of all, his manner's impeccable. He's the son my mom always wishes she had.
He's from the South, isn't he?
Yeah, well, but it's also, you know, his mother just raised him well, and mm-hmm. he's got really good manners. But he's also nice. And because of Jon Stewart, we have a relationship with our network where they don't give us a lot of oversight. I mean, it really...
Are they focusing more on Stewart's show?
They're not focusing on either of us. There's so many... Like, if you're on a network show... on a network show, you get a table read and notes because the process is, you know, you do a table read on Monday, you shoot the show on Thursday, and then you recover on Friday. Okay.
Right, and you're getting notes from these corporate people who have no idea what's funny or not.
Sometimes yes, sometimes no. I mean, Marcy Carsey is the most brilliant person, like one of the most brilliant people I've ever met.
Shoot the Cosby Show.
Yeah, we're like, oh, that's Marcy Carsey gave great notes. So it's not, it's hit or miss. But right. What I'm saying is you get these notes, and sometimes what it does to you as a creator, getting notes from other people, is you abdicate your responsibility. You go, my job is to answer their notes. But your job is not to answer their notes. Your job is to make something good, whether they're giving you notes or not. You know, you ought to be able to give your own notes. Okay? But sometimes in that network process, you feel yourself just trying to please somebody else. Well, you know, because the network trusts John so much, and John trusts Steven, we have a relationship with the network where and because of what the time schedule is, we get very few notes. It really is kind of going back to my high school newspaper of like, the inmates are running the asylum, we're deciding what's in the show, and nobody's saying, because there are certain things we've done even recently where if the network had a person there, they would have gone, no, please don't.
Give me an example of something you slipped by.
What happened? I mean, certainly the, like, I gotta believe on a network, that Daft Punk thing, they would have had trouble with.
What was the Daft Punk thing?
Well, Daft Punk is a French techno duo that dress up as robots. And they refused to be interviewed, and they refused to do music live places, and then they actually, they were booked to the show, and then the morning that they were supposed to be there, they said, look, we're going to be on the VMAs, the Video Music Awards, and MTV has said, if we appear on your show, they're going to yank our invitation to be on the VMAs. Like, we like you, but the VMA is a bigger deal to us. Sorry. And we, you know, the head of Comedy Central went to bat for us, everybody, and we just couldn't get MTV to budge. And we made the decision, well, why don't we just tell people? And we told, we, instead of having them, we'll just tell you that why we couldn't have them. And, you know, we read an email on the air that we probably shouldn't have. And like in a network situation, you know, that's Comedy Central gives us a wide leeway.
Did you get any shit for that?
I think the network enjoyed it. I don't think MTV liked it very much. But, you know, I mean, people liked the episode, so.
You know, you mentioned how nice of a guy Stephen Colbert is. And yet he's willing to stand up and put himself in uncomfortable situations. And I think about the president when he did with George Bush, which again I think you probably had a hand in writing.
I had a little hand in that one.
Can you tell us that experience?
Well, I can't do his side of it because he was in Washington and I was still in New York. I was one of the guys who, like, it's a roast, right? Like, I mean, that was our thought. like, we... Okay, so, like, it's me and one other writer and Steven who did the vast majority of it. And, you know, I didn't know how it was going or whatever. A friend of mine is in the middle of a divorce and he's, like, telling me about his divorce at this pizza restaurant, and my phone starts blowing up from the other guy who wrote it. He's texting me going, are you watching this shit? And like, I'm like, not now, and whatever, it's crazy, you know? you'd have to ask Steven the story because it's like, from his perspective, like he goes, the audience isn't mic'd, so the people in the back of the house are laughing, but you can't hear them. The people in the front, obviously, they didn't find it so amusing. But like my experience with that was, you know, I'm very grateful for who our audience is. You know, every job you have, you're working for somebody. You know what I mean? It's like I did a show with our friend Betsy Thomas. I don't know if you know Betsy.
Betsy,
yeah, she's great. But it, like, it is a show where the audience is largely teenage girls. And it's like, that's not, you know, my...
That's not your demographic.
That's not my demo. And like the first time I realized how cool our audience was when that happened and people are racing to defend us online, and I go, wow, these are great people. You know, like from our privilege is that like 2% of America like watches our show. Like it's not like, I mean, like the big crowd's coming for Rick Bayless tonight.
Right.
Like, but they're like this great 2% of like, you know, people who are organizing every recycling drive in America, and they're just, you know what I mean? Like these intelligent people who give a shit. And that was like the first time I kind of realized how good our audience was to us was through that, because like people were trying to kick Stephen when he was down or whatever. And like there are people writing.
But did he know, like when you wrote those jokes, did he know that like he was going in the lion's den?
A little bit. I mean, he tells a story of his wife trying to talk him out of a couple of those jokes. But again, roast. We thought, you know.
But you're not there. I mean, you're not in the fire.
Well,
you're back in New York in a pizza restaurant. That's what I think is so interesting about Stephen Colbert, is like there's this really nice side, and then there's this really, and I think you touched it in this story about him not wanting to join the group with Koeckner,
the
cool kids. There's this like, this guy's got like a conscience, don't you think?
I think it's fair to say. I don't want to, you know. Again, it's like I don't want to overstep, you know.
Overstep what?
I don't know. Just psychoanalyze a guy.
I do it all the time.
Oh, fair enough.
That's the part of the, that's what I
that's,
love.
That's what the show's about, I'm sorry. I'll psychoanalyze myself. But, you know, I mean, the thing is he's braver than I am, no question about that.
Have to be brave and be a nice guy. Because you were telling me backstage, you're like, I can be an asshole sometimes. When I was in Second City, I pissed off
that
ads.
That was for private consumption.
Was it really?
People, no.
But you say you can be an asshole, but I don't really... I mean, I've known you for a long time. I can see you get passionate about stuff and angry about stuff, but I've never experienced you being an asshole.
Yeah, I mean, Second City brought out the worst in me. Mm-hmm. So you would have had to be backstage with my touring company when I was blaming people for my own problems.
But here's the thing. Here's the thing, one of the reasons... I love doing the show, is you did not have an easy time here in Chicago. You did not have an easy time here at Second City, is that correct?
Well, I mean, they didn't really like me that much, if that's what you mean. I mean, like, I had an easier time than some people. I'm very fortunate for who I was able to work with all through, like, the levels and all through I.O. and stuff like that. I mean, you know, the best comedy teachers you have are your peers. And, like, somebody who's intense like Koechner is, like, just spending all that time with him, you're going to lab school with him because he's going, you know, this can be funnier, this can be better, right. Let's work harder. You know what I mean?
Do you remember that time we did that trade show, Koechner and I, and you were doing, it was, we were doing a Seinfeld ripoff. Yeah. I was Brainer, which was George.
Yeah.
Some generic name for Kramer because they couldn't use it.
Yeah.
And you were writing.
I was on some other.
Oh, that was a disaster. That was such a disaster.
Well, but to tell you who Koechner is, he kept going, this script can be better. Can you fix it?
Can you say, Dave, this is a trade show. Who cares?
But he doesn't walk out there going, I'm going to be lame.
No.
You know? And there's something to be said for
yes.
that.
Yes.
So, where were we?
You did not have an easy time at Second City because at one time they were actually going to promote you. Do you remember this?
I don't remember them ever thinking about promoting you.
I thought they were going to promote you to, tell me if I got this story wrong, they were going to promote you to a stage, Northwest.
I don't remember that.
They were never going to promote you.
No, I don't think so.
Did you quit Second City or did they fire you?
Well, a little both, eventually.
Okay.
Like, I'm somebody who, like, is afraid to move on, so I was clinging desperately to whatever money I could make. So, I think we mutually agreed that I should quit, I think was.
Okay.
However you guys would characterize that, I would say.
Yeah.
But it's like, I don't think they mistreated me in retrospect. Because you gotta look at it from their perspective. You know, in Chicago, there's like, 200 good people or whatever, 150 good people. Mm-hmm. They get to pick like 20 of them to like. That doesn't mean they dislike the other 180. Like, at that time, if you had to go, who do you think, if you said to me, whose career would you rather have, yours or Adam McKay's, I'd go, I'd rather have Adam's too. Like, I would have picked Adam over me too. But I don't have that choice. I don't get to do that. You know, I got to just bet on me regardless. So, you know, at the time, there was a certain amount of bitterness. Because nobody likes somebody going, you know what? You're the fifth best of what you do that I know. You know? Nobody likes that.
But you have to say, too, that the path was much narrower. To say that you'd write for a Colbert or Daily Show, that wasn't even in the consciousness.
No, because they didn't exist.
It was like you were going to do main stage and then Saturday Night Live.
Well, it's funny. I actually like went... to, like, this was sort of something for my younger self. Like, when was this? The summer or something? I went and I gave a free workshop over at Second City just to tell them what's in, like, the people are there now. Just to give them some idea of, like, what the lay of the land is. Because when you're in Chicago, you just don't know. You know, and I used to joke when Tyrone and I were working on like Cosby or something, that I wanted to do a seminar in Chicago called "There Are Other Jobs than Saturday Night Live," like just it's a 5-minute seminar called "There Are Other Jobs Other Than Saturday Night Live."
And basically,
think about looking for one.
Right. And basically, you you just print out a list and hand it to everybody.
It's called the TV Guide.
Right.
You know. But like when you're here, you don't like. I mean, remember. Like, particularly in the 80s, when nobody was getting any work, and, like, Myers was going to Saturday Night Live.
Mike Myers,
And everyone's going, like, wow, what would be... And then we started to think it was a choice, going, I'm not some sellout who's going to get a job.
Yeah.
Like, you know, you had no idea that, like, how the mechanics of, you know, you thought it was, like, a lightning bolt from Zeus to get anything... being far from show business as Chicago is, which in some ways I think is good for all of us because it means you focus on, you? And like, well, what is it, you know, like, what is it that I do that could be valuable to somebody, you know, as opposed to, you know, in New York and LA, some of these young people, they're improvising 6 months and they're going like, okay, now how do I get a sitcom? Which, you know, is going to stunt your growth.
Well, I remember, you remember when Colbert got the touring company. And it, he was in the touring company with
Farley. He and Farley got hired at the same
time. People, and we were at the Improv Olympic together, right, at that time.
Yeah.
And people were like, well, Colbert, he was working in the box office. He's a kid from Northwestern. That, you know, like, there was that, all that, until, you know, we saw him and we're like, oh, this guy's great. But there was that, like, that suspicion, you know? Like, if he didn't come from the Improv Olympic, how dare they hire somebody like that?
Right. I just, in case Stephen is listening to this later, I never thought that, Stephen.
Okay. But that was something that you know, when people got hired, regardless of it was Steven or whatever, there was always that, like, oh, I can't believe they hired that guy.
Well, I mean, there's also this feeling of almost like male sports team ranking of, like, you're in the World of Improv and you're going, okay, well, he's number 5 improviser. I'm probably number 8. But what they do hiring number 10? That's fucking bullshit, man. And there's like, that doesn't exist. There's no master list of who's good at something. But it's like, I gotta say, like, all those experiences for me, anyone that's sort of embittering, I did it to myself. Like, I very much had this feeling like, after 3 improv classes, I should be on main stage. It's like, it was nobody
else.
So
did you come in entitled when you got hired?
Probably. I did everything entitled, so I probably did that entitled. I mean, a little bit. I mean, I was very excited. But then, like, my experience with Second City was, they hired me off an audition where back then I was a pretty good improviser. Later on, you'll see what's happened. because I was relatively funny or whatever. But what I'm not good at is almost anything else. Like, I can't sing, I can't dance, you know, I do not have good stage posture. You know what I mean? And so they got me in there and they went, what a nightmare. Like, we gotta teach this guy, like, a song, and this is, I mean, everybody else was on pitch and he dragged the whole thing down. So, like, it was a bad realization for them. Like, I used to go, I'm not the one who said I could sing and dance. But it's still, you know, it was an issue.
All right, so let's improvise. I'm having such a good time catching up with you. Mm. How are we doing on time, John?
It is
4:40. So let's do a 3-minute improv scene and then come back and talk about it. All right?
Sure.
Okay.
You get this. You do
great.
All
we need a suggestion. Give us a location.
Chicago Pizza Store.
A Chicago pizza store?
Yes.
Okay, a Chicago pizza store. I brought you here for your birthday.
Yeah.
You don't seem excited.
Well, I don't know. I mean, my doctor just told me that, you know, I got to lose some weight.
Carl, that's bullshit. You are not overweight at all. Well, you got to get, it's your birthday.
I mean, the stress test, it came in and he's like, I mean, you should have seen the expression on his face.
I was there with you. I saw his expression.
Thank you for coming to the doctor.
Hey, no problem.
I know the moment I started to cry was a bit much.
No, no, I liked it. I thought it was, like, really vulnerable and really cool.
That's a vulnerable situation for you.
Yeah.
All right, well, you know what? I'm gonna put that aside for one day.
One day.
I still have the cholesterol level of a 20-year-old. Let's go in.
Yes.
Let's go in deep. Let's not half-ass this shit.
No. I already pre-ordered it.
What do you do?
I got sausage. Yeah. I got green pepper on half of it.
Half of it? You know, I don't do the green pepper.
Yeah, and I got salad on the other half.
All right. Yeah. Hey, feel good about it.
Yeah, so you won't have to feel guilty or anything.
All right. All right. Good.
Okay.
Somebody will come here and they'll see us in just a second. I wanted to come like when nobody was here, because I know how you feel like when they say happy birthday and stuff like that.
I mean, I don't like the center of attention.
I know.
You know, it reminds me of when I was a child and the people would sing happy birthday and I'd throw up and react really. Okay.
So we're just going to chill out here for a minute. You know, I already called and put our name in. So they told them that when we come here to hang out in the kitchen for a couple minutes so you get comfortable with the space. So sit down.
Thank you.
I'm going to go get a chair outside.
Don't look too far.
I'm not going to go. Just keep talking. So,
Carl, okay. I'm right here.
Okay. I bring my own chair.
I know.
Because of my posture, this makes me sit up straight.
I know. I was at the doctor with you, too.
Yes. I'm sorry I got angry at him. I'm sorry.
God had a code.
Yeah.
God had a code.
And if it wasn't for you, you blocked that punch, I was going to take him out.
I mean, punching a guy with your back, with your posture, but who knows what you're going to do?
It's bullshit. They said they would take Blue Cross and Blue Shield, and then when I got in there, they said they wouldn't.
I know, it's bullshit. He wants you out of pocket.
Right.
He wants you out of pocket.
Right.
That kind of tension?
Oh.
Yeah, see?
Yeah, and no wonder my blood pressure was as high as it ever was. If you weren't sitting on my stomach like that, I think it would have been much worse.
Yeah, well, definitely. I mean, that's what they said.
I should pay you out of pocket.
That's really nice.
Yeah.
Thank you.
You don't have to look at the menu because I've already ordered. I know you want a dessert. I got that.
I'm not supposed to.
I know, but here's the thing. You're type 1 diabetes, okay?
Yeah.
All right?
I have type 1.
Yes. As long as we walk back to the car, we're going to be fine. Okay?
I'm good.
You know, you look so great for someone who's 48. You were so nervous. We could have gone that scene much longer, don't you think?
Yeah.
You know? I thought you did great. What did you think? It was really fun improvising with you.
My goal now when I improvise is to be more physical than that.
So, okay.
Like if I'm going to kick myself in front of these people, I'd say more physicality.
Mm-hmm.
But relationally, I thought it was good.
Yeah, it was really fun. It was really easy. And I don't think that we really got to improvise a lot together in Chicago.
No, I would sit in with your guys' team every once in a while, but sometimes I'd sit in because you weren't there.
Okay. Yeah.
It's like Colbert and I figured out we did 2 shows together the entire time we knew each other, because the only time I would ever be in on Blue Co. is because he wasn't there.
Mm-hmm. Blue Co. was a
touring company.
Touring company.
And I was in Red Co.
Was there anything you would have done differently in that scene?
Oh, I wish Sharna was here to tell me.
Sharna.
Just more active. I would have physically, I would have done something physical. But other than that, that's what I'm second guessing myself about. Mm-hmm.
It was, I had so much fun.
Yeah, I enjoyed it.
I really did.
I enjoyed it. We found a relationship between those guys. I like the fact they went to the doctor together.
Yeah, that was nice.
Like in a Herald, then I'd want the two of us going to the doctor together.
Right. All right, so we're going to take some questions because we got a lot of Stephen Colbert and Tom Purcell fans here. So, Jerry.
Your dad is Chuck Purcell?
Yeah, Charles Purcell from Loyola Law School.
Yeah, I went to law school when he was the dean there.
Oh, awesome. Yeah.
There's our pitch.
Were you afraid of him?
I never had him for a class. I was a skinny, bald guy.
My father was not bald. Not that, he was tall.
I went to school in the 60s. If you didn't have hair down to your shoulders, you wouldn't.
Okay, yeah, fair enough.
Were you intimidated by him? Was he a tough dad?
What my father was like is he was the toughest grader at the law school. His reputation would be tough grader.
But how is a father?
Well, he's a tough grader as a father. You know what I mean? It's like at times, because he had a deep voice where he could command authority like a law professor does. Mm-hmm. And when he was mad at you, he would call, like his kids, he'd call you doctor. He'd like, he'd use the sentence this way. Well, listen, doctor, when you are paying the bills, you can make the decision. Like that, used like that. I like my dad, but it's like, I was afraid of him sometimes, sure. Right. I don't think he's much of a father figure if you're not.
Great, another question. Yes, back here. Yes, you.
I'm curious, Stephen Colbert probably won't, the show won't last for the rest of your life. What are your, what's your idea of your career after the show?
Wow, my agent was just asking me that. I mean, I have a lot of ideas of my own stuff. I mean, I wouldn't be surprised if Stephen and I do something together in the future as well. Just because we enjoy each other's company, enjoy each other's creativity. So I wouldn't be surprised if we went off and did something else. But like, it would probably be to like work on one of my own ideas, you know, not late night, probably more along the lines of a scripted show. And much more likely to be television than movies, because one of the things that I'm spoiled about the show that we've got is you do one, next one up. You know what I mean? So you can't hate on your... Some of them will be better than others, you know what I mean? And it's like the process of the urgency, you got to get it up, you got to do it, and then it's gone. I'm spoiled by it. And you see these people with movies where it's like 5 years, you keep getting notes and you keep rewriting the same jokes for 5 years. Does not sound attractive to me. So I wouldn't be surprised if it, like, you know, I would love to do something where we weren't, where I was not doing 161 a year. I'd like to do something where it's like, you know, 16 and then sit around for months. But, you know, like, I would imagine, like, something like of the feel of that pilot I did, where it's like very quirky characters and that sort of thing.
Great. Another question? Right over here.
Hi. You mentioned just a second ago that you guys have to produce a lot of material quickly.
Yeah.
How do you guys process it that uniquely like that?
Well, I mean, an important thing, and like, I don't know how many of you are improvisers, young writers, or whatever. Like, a thing we do is we read a lot of stuff out loud. Because my eyes will find certain jokes funny that my ears think are terrible, and vice versa. I gotta look at it and go, that's not much, and I'll hear the character do it. So we do a read down at like 1:30 every day of what's been produced in the morning. And, you know, stuff that we don't get a chance to read down, you know, I'll read it, or various of us will read it and get opinions for rewrites of it. We're always constantly, like we call it chopping wood on it, or distilling it. It's like we say that, like the first draft of something is like growing corn, and then how do you make it into whiskey? Like my advice to younger writers is, it's longer than it needs to be. It's more precious than it needs to be. Mm-hmm. Cut it down, make it shorter, get rid of the halvesies, and it'll compact. And so for us, the process oftentimes is one of constantly tightening up till the moment. I mean, we're rewriting the script 20 minutes before Stephen starts performing it.
Oh, yeah.
And what we're largely doing is we're making it tighter, shorter. Like, the time, you can say that bit of information faster than you think. People are gonna get it. You know, is there a shorter way to get the idea across? Because the wordiness, it's asking a lot of your audience. You know, those sort of self-indulgent couplets that you throw into stuff, like, it just kills your audience. It's like, they get it. They get that you think it's real cool. Like, we have the statement, that's more clever than funny. You know what I mean? And then sometimes my favorite things are what's blocking the thing from being good. It's like, oh, that was a real clever thought you had there, Tom. No one's gonna laugh at it, but it certainly is. Certainly is clever. And so that's how you process it. I think it's like, and we use the, like, first day, Stephen gets all the writing and goes, let's not be precious about our stuff. We got a lot of stuff to get out of here. Everyone's gonna get plenty on, but we can't be too precious. And we don't say good or bad. We say working, not working. Something's working or it's not working. It's not working yet. We can get it to working. You know what I mean? And our writers are amazingly hardworking people. Like, the show is good, or when it's good, I mean, Steven's a huge part of it, but another huge part of it is our writers who are in the salt mines with two big assignments a day that they have to do lightning quick. And, you know, we've been fortunate enough to have some people there, some from the very beginning, some from very close to the beginning, and they do amazing work.
How many hours did you put
me?
In a day? Yes.
I work.
You still work really hard?
Some of it's wasted time.
Good to hear that.
But, like, I'm usually there about 9 o'clock in the morning, and it's rare that I leave before 10 at night on Monday through Thursday.
Mm-hmm.
That's just how it works, you know.
But because you're an executive producer. If I'm a writer on the show, what kind of hours am I putting in?
You're probably there by 9:30, and we have two shifts of writers. One shift will stay late on alternate days. So half the writers will stay until about 7:30, and the other half gets to leave at about 6:30.
Now, I asked this question, and I don't mean this as insulting, but you have 12 people, and it's basically 22 minutes a day for
right.
4 days a week.
Yeah. You'd think it'd be pretty easy.
Yes.
Come on down. I'd love to have you for a while. I mean, the problem is that some of the great ideas you're ever going to have take 30 seconds to write. By the time you've formulated the idea and get it out of your mouth, that is a good, funny scene. But sometimes you're going to have an idea that's not that good, and you're going to have to work hundreds of hours to get it to just even mediocre.
But can't I do that in 30 hours? Do I have to be there 40, 50 hours?
Well, I mean, what I'm doing is...
You've always worked hard.
Well, yeah, because I'm insecure, but there has to be like oversight and people reading stuff. Like, a lot of my work is answering emails and doing sort of businessy sort of stuff, but also, like, I got to read all the scripts and have opinion on all the scripts, and you know, it's just the unfortunate thing about comedy that. You know, the first blurt on a lot of things is really good, but things that you know have potential, but you haven't seen your way through it sometimes, it's just a lot of work, you know?
I just want to end here. What would you tell people that want to get a job at the Colbert Report? What advice would you give them?
Well, I mean, like, I will talk to, like, the Second City and stuff like that. It's not that... We want to read, like, show business is set up so I don't never read you, okay?
What do you mean by that?
There are all sorts of roadblocks to keep people who are not serious about their craft from me having to read them, okay?
Read their packet.
Read their packet. Like, the way you get hired on our show is you write a packet at a time of our direction, so we know how long it took you, of our show, and then we read it.
So you say, okay, we need this back by...
Yeah, in a week. Usually you get a week, and this is what you have to do with
it.
And so, like, that's how you get hired, and then we read them, and we grade them, and then we meet some people, and we, you know, we make sure that somebody's the right fit for us. You know, how do you get there? How do you get to that point is, you know, I always say to people, like, improvise if you're a writer, you know, because then you'll get some idea about, like, what you said, like, I'm back in the pizza restaurant.
Uh-huh.
You know, when you're a writer in comedy, you're always shoving somebody out there and going, hey, I think this will work, you know, and, like, you've got to have some fiduciary responsibility in that. But the way you get these jobs is you just keep putting it out there. You keep writing. You're not afraid of doing hard work. You're not afraid of doing a lot of scripts. The first time you write a Saturday Night packet, or the first time you write a pilot, or the first time you write for us, chances are you're not going to get that gig. And you just have to keep working. You know, trust that your hard work will eventually pay off. You know, and you know, I always say read it to your girlfriend or your boyfriend. Like. They will tell you if something isn't working. You know what I mean?
So don't send it in until you've read it out loud to somebody.
Yeah, because, you know, like, the jokes that your friends laugh at, there's a good chance I'll laugh at them. You know, if it's like this long meandering thing that's just like, even if there's something there, if it's taxing, you know, you're not going to get the job. So, you know, make your friends laugh. Like, share your voice. Come up with the sorts of things that you think would be funny. And like, show it to your friend, your girlfriend, your boyfriend, your write, you know, somebody you used to write with, or somebody you improvise with, or something like that. And like, listen to them when they go, this works, this doesn't, I wish this was shorter. And like, you kind of have to be for yourself when you're looking for a job, your own editor. Because in Hollywood, there are four piles. I always say this to people, the four piles. You go to some like intern, like the person who's sitting in front of the office and walk in, there are four piles when they're hiring writers. There's a little pile, a kind of little pile, medium-sized pile, and this huge pile. That's A, B, C, D, okay? If you're not in the A pile, you better know somebody. You better really know somebody. And so what you're trying to do is get a packet that stands out, that makes people laugh. And a good group to test it on are the people who already think you're funny, you know, which would be like your wife, your boyfriend, your girlfriend, you know, your friends, and you go, I think this is funny. And like, they would look at it and you send it out that way, you know, or you write it for them with going, I bet they, you know, I bet Jimmy would like this joke. You know what I mean? Where it's like you really have this intention towards it, because if you just kind of throw it out there, you're not making yourself better. And it's just, like, there's a lot of jobs out there. Everyone's really hungry for the people who are actually funny. You know, like, there are constantly jobs out there. And, you know, and the good people always work, eventually. Like, we had a guy we almost hired, and then The Daily Show hired him. You know, like, the good people eventually work, but they're good because they keep writing, and they keep putting it out there, and they're kind of fearless about it. I mean, you're just going to get some rejection. But the only way to get better is to do it. So that's
Tom Purcell, thank you so much for being my guest. Stay there really quickly.
And there you have it. Another episode of Improv Nerd is in the can. This is called the Tom Purcell episode. And of course, I want to thank my guest, Tom Purcell, for extending his stay here in Chicago to do the show. I truly, truly appreciate it. I also want to thank all the good people here at Stage 773, our home base, the people that make us feel like rock stars, and also my producer, Ben Caprero. You've probably figured this out because you're smart people. We are on feralaudio.com amongst some other great podcasters, because it's a podcast collective. Like Dan Harmon and Chelsea Peretti and Steve Agee and Todd Berry and Matt Dwyer. So go to feralaudio.com and check it out. And if you like what we're doing here at Improv Nerd, there's a donate button, which hopefully sends a little money our way. If you want more information about me, Jimmy Corain, and my award-winning classes and my Improv Nerd blog, which will always give you tips to becoming a better improviser, go to jimmycorain.com. And if you want me to bring my workshops and an Improv Nerd to your improv theater or college, you can contact me at jimcorain@gmail.com. And don't forget to like our Improv Nerd Facebook page. It really helps with my low self-esteem. I want to thank our sponsors again, Hotel Lincoln and Uncle Fun, both here in Chicago. And I want to thank you for listening. And remember, until next time, walk, don't run. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd, oh yeah. Jimmy's a nerd, he's a nerd.
Let's say Seinfeld was on an island and he was blowing Boris Karloff. What would that be like?
It might go something like this. Oh, Mr. Karloff, I loved you and Frankenstein, and I love giving you a blowjob. Why, Mr. Seinfeld, I love having you fuck.